something will happen that will change the attitude towards small animal practice. And I think the most likely one is there will be a disease flare-up in either animals or humans, which is transmissible between dogs and cats and humans. And that will kill small animal practice overnight.
This is one of the possible risks to veterinary medicine as we know it, that veterinarian, veterinary historian and author Bruce Vivash-Jones raised in the second part of our discussion on the history of veterinary medicine. Bruce qualified as a vet in 1951, that is 71 years ago, so he has seen a lot of change. Now, I am sure that you can tell by the introduction that there were a few issues faced while recording this chat, but believe me, it is worth listening to. Bruce's comments on the events that change veterinary medicine, the current state of our profession, and the possible future are insightful. And a quick thank you to 5M Books for supplying me with Bruce's book, The History of Veterinary Medicine and the Animal-Human Relationship.
You are listening to The Vet Podcast, presented by veterinarian Dr. Brian Greger from New Zealand. Join us as we discuss pet health issues from around the world.
Bruce, we finished the previous podcast talking about the Enlightenment and the opening of the first veterinary school in France in 1761. Can this be taken as the birth of modern veterinary medicine as we know it now?
I think the most important thing to say is that at first it progressed was very slow because the amount of knowledge was quite limited. But within a few years, in the 1800s, things started to move ahead. And in the 1800s, the most important things that happened were that we developed vaccines. And Louis Pasteur developed vaccines. Vaccines were the first products that veterinarians could use to control the disease. And secondly, an Englishman called John Ramsay in 1863 called a conference in Hamburg of all leading veterinary professors in the veterinary school to talk about the epidemics of rinderpest, bovine malaria, foot and mouth disease. What was to be done to try to control this? Because Europe was split into separate countries, the countries didn't cooperate. So the veterinary world, in this consensus, that started to work out a plan to help the countries to cooperate with each other. And they did. And gradually, rinderpest came under control and the other disease. And that first meeting, called by John Ganty, became the World Veterinary Association, which still exists now. Now, the next most important thing happened because we didn't have any specific remedies for anything. A few odd herbal things like digitals came in, but by and large, virtually all of the medications and salves and syrups and potions used were just on the off chance that they might help. Some of them did help. But the real breakthrough came through in 1935 when the German Domec developed sulfonylamide. These sulfonylamides were the first antibacterial substance, and that made an incredible change in veterinary medicine. At last, they could treat a lot of diseases, or bacterial ones. And then this was improved in 1940 when the antibiotics came in, penicillin, and then from 1945 onward, other antibiotics, and newer anesthetic agents, and then hormone and endocrine products. By the end of the 1900s, we had all of the armory of substances that offered veterinarians a good chance of treating and preventing a high proportion of diseases.
There seems to almost be a common thread with these diseases that you're talking about, that they are mostly production animal diseases. When did medicine for companion animals, for cats and dogs, start to become a thing?
Well, certainly dog practice existed from the late 1700s and early 1800s, but only for the more wealthy classes. The sort of medications they used were simple, novel, yet effective, and the major problem with the dogs was a rabies, and then a lack of effective rabies control meant that many people did not want dogs. Rabies control became pretty effective by the early 1900s, 1920s, and companion animal practice as such really only developed after the 1945 war. And from 1950 onward, companion animal practice began to grow. The amount of effective medication was comparatively small. Antibiotics were incredibly valuable. Vaccines, again, the distemper in dogs was a key factor in developing companion practice. And a very low-priced vaccine, when that came into use, the distemper in the majority of the major countries, well, Western Europe and elsewhere, the distemper ceased to be a problem. But it's worth noting also that because it ceased to be a problem, a number of pet owners have progressively decided they don't want to vaccinate against it because it isn't a problem. And certainly in Britain, the odd cases are now popping up again. So even though we think that we have controlled their diseases, always lurking somewhere.
Can we just go back a few steps, Bruce? You were talking about the development of drugs, of the antibiotics and the vaccines and the anaesthetics. Now, surgery without anaesthetics isn't particularly easy. I would imagine that with anaesthetics becoming a lot more effective, the surgical techniques would have become a lot more effective. You have got longer periods that you can have an animal anaesthetized for. You have got a lot better pain relief. Surgery would have had to have gone ahead in leaps and bounds.
Oh, yeah, without any question. I mean, when one reads the early work of people who operated on animals without any anaesthesia at all, not only was it horrifying for the poor creature concerned, but the veterinarian, he just had to be as quick as he possibly could in performing the operation. As soon as anaesthesia came in, the veterinarian had got time to do his operation carefully, and also he knew that he wasn't going to get hurt. Anaesthesia was called for ether, but it wasn't until just after the war that the barbiturate anaesthesia came in, and in small animal practice, this would revolutionize surgery. The barbiturate anaesthesia made small animal veterinarians could become increasingly involved in surgical procedures, in orthopedic work, and then later anaesthetics became an essential part of veterinary practice. Small animal surgery now is without question actually equal to human surgery.
Yeah, actually that brings me on to something else that I have noticed has changed. Is one is the cost of veterinary procedures that are being done and the expectation from the owners that they're going to be done, whether they're going to be able to pay for them or not. And the next step on from that is the pet insurance industry, which has come about because that started in our part of the world. That was sort of the late 20th century, I suppose. Things like that, in my opinion, have made a huge difference to veterinary medicine because people now have the ability to pay for these tricky procedures.
Yeah, I have to be very careful when I say that I'm not in practice. And when I was in practice, it was a long time ago. But there is a feeling that veterinarians become pressurized to say to their clients, take up insurance. And as a result, I have a friend who had a dog that was unwell. He was a veterinarian also, retired, and went to see his local vet and said, what do you think the problem is? And the immediate reply is, well, we better take some blood samples, and we better do this, and we better do that. And he suddenly found he was racking up the bill of a considerable amount of procedures that he didn't think were necessary. But on the other hand, we now got into a situation where if you're the veterinarian undertaking the work and something happens and your health be to blame because you didn't do the blood test, I would find it very hard to be in practice nowadays.
I have to admit, Bruce, that I'm a man of your own heart. I do feel that a lot of animals are overdiagnosed. The art of being a veterinarian is lost because you can't quantify it. That's a whole new podcast, I think. Something else that we noticed starting at the same time, Bruce, was actually the change in the ownership of practices. It's going from private practices. Now the corporates are moving in. That's actually quite a big change, I think, in the profession.
Well, yeah. When the corporates started, it was quite a good idea. Now I think there is increasing concern that isn't a good idea. We're beginning to see two or three major corporations with huge ownership of practices in several countries. We have one corporate in particular who is the largest owner of veterinary practices in the USA and in the UK and increasingly in Europe. Now, it's a difficult thing because these large corporates offer a lot of help to the practices that they own and they control, but at the same time, people working in the practices find they are having to have certain targets and so on. Well, veterinary practice, to my mind, is not like that. Veterinary practice is relationship with the client and the animal, and it becomes targets and norms. And a lot of the younger graduates who want to get into practice, a corporate practice provides them with an opportunity to start up and to get going. I think that one of the particular problems that certainly happened in the UK and I believe elsewhere is that in previous times when I was in practice and probably when you were, majority, if not all practices, were run by men. And then the older ones retired, the younger ones took over the share, and so it carried on. But with the women, they don't always want to sign up to a lifetime work in the practice. They want time off to have children, to live with their family and so on, and then rejoin. So as a result of this, a lot of the practices found that the only way to keep the practice going was to sell it to the corporate. Now, one would have to blame the women for this, but this is one of the changes, one of the social changes that has happened in veterinary practice and has actually altered the way that practice is run. How it's going to work out in the future is unclear, I think, at this time. I mean, we also have at least one corporate chain over here in the UK has suggested they're going to start their own veterinary school and train their own graduates. If that's happened, this would be a very significant change.
We've moved to the present day, moved to the 21st century now, Bruce. And there's just, I mean, to me, there are a number of standout things that have changed in the profession from when I qualified, which was not quite as far back as you, it was the early 80s. And one of them is the, I don't know, for the want of a term, the feminization of the veterinary profession. Another one is, well, two things that go together. One of them is antibiotic resistance. And what goes hand in hand with that is the slowdown of new medications, particularly antibiotics, coming online. We've got the corporates. There is an increased concern, and to be fair, quite rightly, on animal welfare. Where do you see the future of veterinary medicine going with this groundswell of changes?
Well, antimicrobial resistance is a significant factor. And I think, without any question, antibiotics have been overprescribed. It's quite true that there is a declining input of new chemical and biological substances coming into the marketplace. I think that the COVID vaccine situation has created a much greater interest in vaccine per se and the newer technology. And I think we're quite likely to see more vaccines, more interesting, valuable vaccines come into the marketplace. Now, what's going to happen to veterinary practice? Well, what I have learned about prophecy is that you cannot foretell is the future. But we must learn from the past, I think. And the past of veterinary medicine indicates that it's highly likely that in the future, veterinary practice will not be like it is today. In other words, it will change in some radical way. You go back 100 years, no one could have predicted small animal practices. Go back 200 years, no one could have predicted the end of the horse era. The horse was the major animal and was going to be for all time until somebody invented railway engines and motor cars. So something will happen that will change the attitude towards small animal practices. And I think the most likely one is there will be a disease flare up in either animals or humans, which is transmissible between dogs and cats and humans. And that will kill small animal practice overnight almost. So that is one, not prophecy, but I think it is a great risk hanging over the profession. I think there is an opportunity for veterinary medicine to do as they do in the USA, concentrate much more on food hygiene and food production. There is a big role for the veterinarians in slaughterhouses in controlling their food and its production. Unfortunately, this isn't the sort of work the average new graduate wants to go into. They became veterinary surgeons because they wanted to treat animals. And I think out of that comes, how is veterinary education going to go in the future? I mean, we in the UK now have a surprising situation. We've got 11 veterinary schools, either working or under construction. And still, there seems to be a demand for more veterinarians. At some time, it's quite likely that governments are going to wake up to the fact that they have to provide significant subsidy to universities, to veterinary schools, to train veterinary surgeons. Now, it's obviously been the government's role to ensure that the food supply of the country is kept safe. Are governments going to be totally happy about financing new graduates to treat cats and dogs? I think that with financial stringencies, this may well become a factor. And they're related to that. I think there'd be a stronger possibility that veterinary courses will be structured so that to all staff of undergraduates doing a common syllabus, when you get into the clinical years, you either specialize in farm animals or companion animals. So you will have two separate veterinary degrees.
Bruce, you have just given us a lot of food for thought here. I think discussing the future of medicine is probably a good place to wrap this discussion up. thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Well, thank you, Brian. I have enjoyed it, and it's been good to meet you.
Now, I don't normally do this, but thank you very much for making it to the end of the podcast. I appreciate that the audio quality isn't particularly good, and that is probably an understatement, but we got there in the end. Now, if you want to have a look at this book of Bruce's, and this is where I have to give a plug to 5M Books, who supplied me with a copy of this book, go to 5mbooks.com. The book is called The History of Veterinary Medicine and the Animal-Human Relationship. And that's it for another episode of the Vet Podcast. All of our links are in one place at beacons.ai/vetpodcast. That is beacons.ai/vetpodcast. And while you're there, don't forget to buy us a coffee. On behalf of me, Brian Greger, and everybody else involved in the making of this podcast, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you again soon.